You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. Coming up, a new analysis from UW Extension zeroes in on income inequality here in Wisconsin. We'll talk to one of the report's co-authors about what they found out. First, when you're making your breakfast in the morning or throwing a lunch together for the day, do you reach for the same thing again and again? If so, you are not alone. There are plenty of people out there who eat the same meal day in and day out. But for those who don't, those routine eaters can be an endless source of fascination. Our next guest dug into these lunch and breakfast habits and what they say about our food culture. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Do you eat the same meal each and every day? If so, why? Is there an appeal to it? Are you hooked by the convenience, the cost savings? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Joe Pinsker is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers families and education. His recent piece there is called The People Who Eat the Same Meal Every Day. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And you write, Joe, that this is a personal topic for you. You are one of these people who has this routine go-to meal.
You're correct. That was the inspiration for my article. I've been eating the same thing more or less for about 5 years now at work. Bean and cheese tacos with various assorted things on the side.
And those assorted things shake it up a little bit.
Well, not a ton. There's always baby carrots. There's always a little bit of tempeh on the side. Really, the thing that rotates is the fruit, which is basically seasonal.
Now, I kind of look at people who eat the same lunch every day and think, oh, that's a little weird. But then if somebody asks me what I ate for breakfast, I basically have a bowl of cereal every single day of the year. So that's no less weird. People for breakfast or lunch, those are the common meals that people will have that routine for.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. I think breakfast is something that people are really okay with a lack of variety in, maybe because they're hustling to get out the door. Dinner is something where they tend to really want variety in, but lunch kind of occupies this middle ground. A lot of people prefer variety, but a lot of people don't. It's unclear exactly how many, but that was what I started to get interested in when I started reporting.
And for the people you talked to in this piece who do have that regular go-to lunch, what were some of the reasons they offered for why they stuck with that one thing?
Yeah, so some of the people said it was more cost-effective. It sort of locked them into bringing something every day instead of going out, and it just made it easier to do that. Some of them said it was one fewer thing to think about every day, and that to me is the biggest reason that that connected to pretty much everything everybody said. There are just so many things going on that not having to stress about making something the night before or throwing something together in the morning, it just made it a lot easier.
That really struck me in your piece. So many people said the gist was there's a lot to think about and worry about and a lot of decisions to make over the course of a workday. This is one thing that you have off the table. If you're eating that peanut butter sandwich, you're eating that peanut butter sandwich.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's definitely a trade-off, and I think people were aware that not putting in that work meant that they wouldn't get as much variety in lunch, but they were pretty okay with it. The people I talked to were, if anything, excited about the fact that this is what they did. They just thought it made sense. It let them think about things they actually preferred to think about more.
And you talked to some experts on the history of humans and food, and the people who want that variety every day, we're the weird ones. Right? Historically, you found out that's not how we rolled.
Yeah, if you look at the scope of human history, and even, I mean, probably the population of humanity today, being able to choose your food is actually not the normal thing. Usually you don't have much say. If you're in a place where there are potatoes as the base of the meal, that's what you have. If you're in a place where rice is the base of the meal, that's what you have. And maybe there are a couple things that rotate other than that, but for the most part, you're just kind of eating the same thing.
Talking to Joe Pinsker from The Atlantic about a piece he wrote about our meal habits and people who have that routine, that go-to lunch that they have more or less each and every day. Or maybe, like me, it's breakfast. I want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Julie is with us in Stevens Point. Julie, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
What's your routine?
Well, it used to be oatmeal, fruit, nuts. And we, about a year and a half ago, meaning my husband and I, for some health reasons, switched our breakfast to bone broth soup with different vegetables. I guess that's our variety because it just depends the time of the year. But we always have mushrooms, onions, usually some kind of greens, and then maybe carrots, maybe beets, maybe cauliflower. We mix the fruit part up. I'm sorry, the vegetable part up for variety, and we just absolutely love it. We just absolutely love it. And go out one meal a week with my parents for breakfast or friends, and that seems to be all the variety we need in the week.
And Julie, apart from it, it sounds like it's probably pretty yummy, but do you like that routine and you get up and you know what's for breakfast?
Yes, it definitely saves time grocery shopping. We get all of our prep work done, maybe Sunday, maybe Monday. Everything's split up where all I have to do is open that Tupperware container, dump it in the soup pot, add some bone broth soup, and we're ready to go. It's a time-saving option for sure, and it tastes good, and we feel like we're getting really a good, nutritious start to the day.
Julie, thank you so much for sharing that. And Joe, Julie mentioned shopping. This is easy to go out and prepare for. Is that something you heard from the lunch routine people you talked to?
Definitely, yeah. I think like the idea of coming up with a different shopping list every week that would give you five different lunches each week for your work week, it just was a little bit stressful. I mean, obviously, yes, we're talking about things that are relatively small in the big picture, but every little thing counts. And I find this in my own grocery shopping. It's nice to just kind of go in, have my little path in the grocery store, know exactly where I'm going to stop, what I'm going to pick up, and just kind of proceed with my day.
Thanks again for the call, Julie. You also talked to some nutrition experts. Did they say, hey, this is good, bad, what?
They said that there really wasn't a danger to it. I mean, here I was worrying that I'd eaten the same thing for 5 years, and I probably should have asked on the front end of that. But yeah, she said, the nutrition expert I talked to, she told me that it really wasn't a big deal as long as the stuff that was in it was nutritious and as long as I was getting some variety in other parts of the day. So it's generally good to get a mix, but eating the same thing for lunch every day isn't in and of itself bad.
And you and some of the people you talk to share another common experience in addition to having this lunch routine. They maybe get some good-natured ribbing from their coworkers.
Yes, this is something I noticed. People in our little work kitchen seem to couldn't help themselves from making comments, observing that I'd eaten the same thing for lunch every day. And the people I talked to for the article said the same thing. I think it's funny. There's definitely, I think, something going on here where people think that people who eat the same thing for lunch every day are kind of robotic, are stiff, they're fine just without any variety. But I actually maintain the opposite. I just seek out variety in other parts of my life.
Do you think about your own lunch differently now, though, after doing the research for this piece?
That's a great question. Well, I definitely am a whole lot more self-conscious about it at work as I shuttle it from the kitchen to my desk because I feel like people look at my plate and say, oh, yep, well, there's Joe. He's eating his tacos again. So if anything, it's made the comments at work worse since I've written about it. But honestly, it works well for me and I'm sticking with it. I learned that it's not going to kill me, so I'm going to keep going.
And did a lot of people, either commenters on the site or others, take you aside or send you a note and say, Joe, I didn't want this out there, but that's me. I'm that routine person.
Yeah, it was really funny. When I wrote this piece, I thought that I was going to get piled onto for behavior that was, you know, boring. And I was so surprised to see that a lot of people on Twitter and a lot of people who emailed me personally, they were saying, I do this too. And they shouted at me and told me what they ate for lunch every day, which I thought was great. So it was nice knowing that I'm not alone out there.
Joe, thanks for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, take care.
That's Joe Pinsker, staff writer at The Atlantic. He covers families and education there. We've been talking about his recent piece, The People Who Eat the Same Meal Every Day. Are you them? Are you the person who eats the same thing every day? Email us, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us, @CentralTimeWPR. Let us know your go-to breakfast or lunch. Coming up, we'll check out a new report on income inequality across Wisconsin and find out why inequality has been growing over the last few decades here in the state and around the country. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get an update on House Democrats' efforts to get the full, unredacted Mueller report and other top stories in our weekly look at national politics. First, growing income inequality is something we hear a lot about, but when we talk about it, it's often as a national or global issue. There's been less focus on how the issue plays out on the local level. A new analysis from the University of Wisconsin Extension is trying to change that by taking a closer look at economic inequality here in Wisconsin. Steve Deller is a professor with UW-Madison's Agricultural and Applied Economics Program. He's co-author of this new analysis. You can find that online at wiscontext.org. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Well, what are you trying to figure out here when you zoom in on Wisconsin and look at the issue of economic inequality?
Well, exactly as you said in the introductory comments, it's a lot of the discussion has been kind of at the national level. So we just wanted to kind of say, is Wisconsin following national trends? Is Wisconsin bucking national trends? Or is there a pattern that we should be aware of?
What are the national trends?
The national trends have been in place now for a number of years. From 1929, when we started collecting this kind of data, up until the mid-1970s, there had been a growing middle class. And that growing middle class, you saw people moving up from lower incomes to upper middle class. And the wealthier were doing better, but not outrageously so. Starting about the mid-1970s, we saw that reverse. And there were two trends going on. One is that the wealthy were doing much, much better than your typical middle-class person. Sometimes you saw that in discussions about CEOs making 500 times what an average worker makes. But we also saw kind of a pressure on the middle class, and a pressure in the sense of that movement from say, working poor, working low income into middle class. That movement's been not occurring. Indeed, it's kind of been being pushed the other way because of the types of jobs that we've been generating.
That's national. How do we compare in Wisconsin when we look at that trend over time?
We're following the same general trend. As usual, Wisconsin kind of follows the national economy, but we're not experiencing this widening income gap to the extent, say, the two coasts are. The two coasts, it really kind of jumps out at you. So we're experiencing it, but not to the same extent as the nation.
But we're the lines follow each other. We're just lower when it comes to measures of inequality.
Exactly. So we still see increasing inequality, but the rate that we're increasing is just a little slower than the national average.
All right, let's drill down a little further now. You went beyond the state level and started to go county by county. What kind of things stood out to you when you did that and tried to figure out which counties were the most or least unequal?
Well, there were the one thing that surprised me is kind of the northern counties. When you think of kind of pockets of very high income folks, kind of the northern suburbs of Milwaukee kind of stand out. But that's because of the fairly concentration of fairly high income folks that are pulling that up. But when you look up into the northern counties, there's a couple that are also popping out. And one of the hypotheses that we have is the retirement migration. We're seeing an increasing flow of fairly well-to-do people moving up to their summer homes. They're converting them into year-round homes, and they're moving in, and that's creating this kind of us and them, the high-income lakefront property owners, and then the rest of the population.
Yes, Sawyer County was one that stood out to me on your charts as the big example in northern Wisconsin.
Yes.
How about outside of northern Wisconsin? Were there places that you saw particular income? Are we looking at income or wealth inequality here, I should say?
We're income inequality. Okay. And that's one of the big challenges with this whole kind of literature is there's a lot of how do you define it? Mm-hmm. For example, how do you define income? Do you include transfer payments as a form of income? For example, do you include unemployment insurance payments, for example, yes or no? Do you include Social Security payments, yes or no? Do you include, I'm retired and I'm drawing Social Security, do you include that? What if I'm on disability and you include? So there's lots of debates, lots of arguments about what's the best way to measure, what's the best way to define income. You'll get slight variations, but the general story still holds true, that we're seeing increasing levels of income inequality because of a growth at the low end and the very wealthy just kind of shooting off into the stratosphere.
All right. I interrupted my own question to digress there, but it's a good digression. So counties outside of northern Wisconsin that you see higher inequality in?
Some of them are university towns. Dane County jumps out as higher, but that's partially because we're a big university town. You also see it in La Crosse County. Part of that is university town. Part are also with La Crosse County is that you've got major hospitals there. So you have some of the higher income associated with the hospitals. So some of these patterns really kind of, when you stop and think about it, really kind of make sense.
Talking to Steve Deller from UW Extension about income inequality, how it plays out around the nation, in the state, and even in counties around the state. Steve, backing out again, why do we worry about income inequality?
Inequality in the U.S., we traditionally have not worried that much about income inequality because we have this notion of the American dream, and that inequality actually, you know, the higher end particularly gives us kind of something to attain to, something that if you work hard enough, you can actually get there. So in that regard, it's people in the U.S. haven't really been concerned about it. I think that's changing, though, and I think that's changing because the middle class is getting pushed downward. And I think it's that pushing downward, a growing pool of the working poor, if you will, that's creating political pressure. Economists kind of will argue whether or not income inequality affects the economy at all. And there's debates about that. But the one area that there's agreement is that it turns into a political problem. And I think we're kind of seeing that anger playing out at the national level and indeed in Wisconsin.
Historically, has this been a political problem, something that it puts a representative government at stake in the long run?
Boy, that's how long have you got to talk about that? I think if you look at the work of Kathy Kramer and the politics of resentment, I think that that's really an income inequality argument, is that folks feel as though they're being left behind and they're resentful. But historically, we have always looked to people that have made significant income as something that we aspire to be. But we feel as though now that upward mobility is being squashed, and now people are there's the politics of resentment. And I think that we're seeing that play out in our politics now.
We've talked some about this in the past. We could spend hours on it. But can you give us a survey of ideas about why? Why we've seen this decades-long rising inequality?
Two things. One is that we're moving towards a service economy. We're moving away from a goods-producing kind of manufacturing-based economy where we had a lot of good middle-class-paying jobs. And a lot of those are going away, and we're shifting towards a service-based economy. One, as we become wealthier as a society, we're spending more of our money on services. And a lot of those services are not very well-paying. Take hospitals, for example. You have a wide distribution of occupations in hospitals. You have well-paid doctors, well-paid specialists, but then you also have, say, janitorial staff or kitchen staff that is not paid as well. We're growing more jobs at that lower level than we are at that upper level.
In the piece, you also mention some people at the top of the scale in financial sectors really just going off the charts, raising that top-end income.
That's part of this. When we shift to services, we have to be really careful here because it's very heterogeneous. We have kind of low-paying personal service types jobs, and then we have the financial markets. And in the financial markets, if you're effective in the financial markets, if you're good at Wall Street, you can become very, very wealthy. So that's kind of the financialization of that part of the economy is growing, and a lot of the occupations that are attached to that are fairly high paying.
A lot of recipes to turn this around involve manufacturing, but in your piece you mentioned new manufacturing capacity doesn't necessarily have that impact. The kinds of jobs are changing.
That's right. It used to be that you could barely make it out of high school and get a really good manufacturing job because you knew the union stewards. Well, the unions are not what they used to be, so that entry level into higher paying jobs is kind of gone. Also, a lot of the kind of root manufacturing that was labor intensive, low skilled has gone overseas. And what we have left in the U.S. is more custom manufacturing, skilled manufacturing, which requires a different set of skills.
I have to know how to program the robots, not how to do the work that the robot's now doing. Might
exactly,
be one example.
Exactly. Or how do I fix this robot when it breaks down? It's a different set of skills.
And speaking of fixing, are there ideas, if people agree that this rising inequality is a problem, are there fixes? Are there solutions people have in mind?
Yes. And the number one is education, is that we can't really create a law that will solve the problem unless you invest in programs that are massive redistribution of income. And I don't think that's going to happen in the U.S. That kind of carries out in Asia, and it carries out in Europe to some extent, but that's not going to happen here. So the only real strategy that we have is to try to create opportunities that people can essentially take full advantage of the opportunities there. But this is a long-term trend, and there is no magic bullet to address it.
But if we need, say, a certified nursing assistant, a well-educated CNA is going to get paid not much more than a less educated CNA, right? Those jobs, those low-paying jobs are still there no matter the education level.
That's exactly right. One of the things that, as I talk to a lot of businesses around the state, is that you could almost say that there's two types of employers in the state of Wisconsin, those that view their employees as their most valuable asset. And they may not be able to pay more, but they can maybe offer benefits that kind of compensate the employee, like on-site childcare, flexible work hours, paid vacation, things like that that just make a good work environment. So I don't make as much money, but I like where I work. The other type of employee employer just tries to keep pressure down on wages. So it depends on which type of employer are you talking about. Can we create payment schemes that are not necessarily reflective in terms of take-home pay, but in terms of a better work environment?
We'll leave it there for now. Steve, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Steve Deller with UW-Madison's Agricultural and Applied Economics Program. He was with us to talk about a new analysis of economic inequality in Wisconsin and how we compare to the rest of the country. You can find that article and some related maps and charts online at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, former Vice President and potential 2020 Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden is facing criticism over reports that he's made inappropriate physical contact with women. We'll hear the details and the reactions coming up. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin saw another down-to-the-wire election yesterday, with conservative Judge Brian Hagedorn holding a lead in the race for state Supreme Court and a likely recount in the works. We'll talk to our Capitol reporter to break down those results. First, it's time for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. House Democrats are moving closer to issuing a subpoena for the full Mueller report. Meanwhile, the White House is dealing with fallout from allegations that it didn't listen to concerns about its approval of security clearances. And former Vice President Joe Biden is facing questions about inappropriate contact with women as he considers entering the race for president. We want to hear your thoughts on the accusations against Biden at 800-642-1234. Do you think his making women uncomfortable with unwanted kisses or contact is disqualifying? Would you still vote for Biden knowing about this? How do you think it compares to allegations like those against President Trump? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Lauren Gambino is a political correspondent for The Guardian. Lauren, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start with the latest on the Mueller report. Lauren, what have Democrats been doing to try to get the full report?
Yeah, we had some action today on Capitol Hill. The House Judiciary Committee, the Democrats there, moved ahead to approve a subpoena to get the full unredacted report from Attorney General Barr. They are demanding the full report. Barr has said he's working through this, you know, nearly 400-page report to redact certain pieces of information that he doesn't believe should be made public. But Congress, at least the Democrats, are arguing that they should be able to see it all, and obviously go through it, in terms of what should be released to the public later. So there's this confrontation, I guess you could say, between the democratically controlled House of Representatives and the Justice Department at the moment. And today's action certainly escalated that. And I guess we'll have to see. Currently, Democrats have not acted on the subpoena. They said they're willing to hold off and discuss with Attorney General Barr. But they said, you know, I think the quote was, in short order, we want to see that report, the full report, or we will issue the subpoena that we approved today.
Yeah, House Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler has been going back and forth with Attorney General Barr over the report. Here's what Nadler had to say today about whether he'll ultimately use this subpoena now.
I will give him time to change his mind. But if we cannot reach an accommodation, then we will have no choice but to issue subpoenas for these materials.
If that happens, that raises some questions about how the Justice Department would respond. Do we have any hints from them, Lauren, at this point?
It is unclear. You know, there's a debate over what Congress should have access to. You know, there's testimony from the grand jury that, you know, there are legal questions over whether Congress should be able to access that and read that because it's obviously meant to be confidential. So this would probably move to the courts. As Congressman Nadler said he's ready to take it to the courts if need be. And so we could probably imagine that that's where it would play out. I'm not sure Attorney General Barr, after the back and forth we've already seen, I'm not sure he would just suddenly say, okay, fine, here's the full report, fully and unredacted. So I guess we'll have to kind of wait and see over these next few days, possibly weeks, but certainly, yeah, Congressman Nadler is ready to play hardball.
Let's move from this confrontation between House Democrats and the White House to a different confrontation between House Democrats and the White House. This one over security clearances. We had this testimony, a transcript released from a whistleblower about the way the White House handled these security clearances. What are we hearing here?
Right. So this is just another front in these investigations led by the, you know, new democratically controlled House. Here we've got a whistleblower who said, you know, that she and others had flagged 25 people saying, you know, they shouldn't be given these clearances. And yet she was overruled by her boss. And we've learned from the New York Times reporting that Trump himself had intervened, at least in the instance of his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to get him a security clearance. So there's a lot of questions here about why there was this intervention, why a non-political public servant was sort of overruled in her assessment of whether someone deserved a security clearance. And, you know, she's come forward. She's doing interviews. She's kind of saying, you know, I came forward out of the public interest, at a public good. I believe this puts the country at risk to have people who, you know, there were some concerns in their background when we did these investigations into the security clearances that they might be susceptible to foreign influence or a number of other things she named. So we'll see how that plays out, but that committee has also issued a subpoena to speak to the manager who is in charge of reversing those assessments.
And that's what House Democrats are doing. Have House Republicans responded to these allegations?
Yes. So they obviously think they've called this a political theater, and they believe that Democrats are being overly zealous in their pursuit by issuing subpoenas, et cetera. There is some back and forth over who's being hypocritical here because Democrats say, well, what about, you know, the Benghazi investigation? What about the emails and investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails? You know, these were all highly political and highly politicized investigations. So there's some back and forth about, you know, obviously at the heart of this, it is political, and Democrats are very interested in pursuing these investigations into the White House and Donald Trump. But they believe that that's why they won in 2018. They believe that they were sent, they were given the majority to, you know, do their oversight role that they believe Republicans weren't doing prior to their victory in 2018. So, I expect to fully see more of this, more of these investigations, even though, you know, the Mueller report concluded and the Mueller investigation is over.
Talking to Lauren Gambino from The Guardian, looking at some of the top stories in national politics this week. The first accusation against Vice President Biden in this series now that we're hearing about came from a former Nevada state lawmaker named Lucy Flores, saying the potential 2020 presidential candidate had made inappropriate physical contact with her. Here's some of what she had to say on CNN last Sunday.
Very unexpectedly and out of nowhere, I feel Joe Biden put his hands on my shoulders, get up very close to me from behind, lean in, smell my hair, and then plant a slow kiss on the top of my head.
Can you talk more, Lauren, about what Flores has said and now some other women have said about this kind of unwanted attention, physical contact from the former vice president?
Yes. So as we just heard, Flores and a few other women have come forward and talked about these sort of encounters with the former vice president that they said made them feel uncomfortable. They're acknowledging that his intent might not have been to make them feel uncomfortable, but ultimately that was the result, and they felt this behavior and this physical contact crossed a line. We're hearing reaction from across the political spectrum. Joe Biden maintains a lot of support, especially among former lawmakers of both sides of the aisle have come to his defense and said this is just the type of politician he is. He's a hugger. He's a kisser. He embraces people physically. That's just who he is. He would never, ever in his wildest dreams intend to make someone uncomfortable. But you're also seeing, especially in this Me Too moment and movement, you're seeing a wider discussion about what is appropriate, personal space, where and how men can touch women or other men. And so you're seeing, I think, and it's being led by, younger women. It's some of the women who are coming forward are relatively younger. And it is, I think there is a generational divide in the reaction. But you saw Nancy Pelosi yesterday saying, you do the arm's length distance when you meet someone you don't know. Just pretend both parties have a cold, and that's how you should approach these sort of interactions with voters or whoever you might be meeting for the first time. You're just seeing all sorts of reactions. I think it's a different conversation than we've been having, I think, with the Me Too moment. These aren't accusations of harassment or assault. These are women saying, he made me uncomfortable with the way he touched me. And that is different. And I think there's a lot of parties eager to have this conversation. As to what it means for his campaign, I guess we'll wait and see. His team seems certainly willing to push back and sort of try to clarify some of these encounters and some of these accusations.
We'll listen to Joe Biden's response in just a moment. I want to bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Alicia is with us in Milwaukee. Alicia, hi.
Good afternoon. My thoughts were that I think Joe Biden is old news as he is representing in his behavior. I was never brought up to touch my colleagues in that manner. I think that type of mindset that would be okay is very old-fashioned, and it dispossesses women of their bodies. I am not here for you to touch, hug, kiss, none of the above. I'm your colleague, and we're both here to do the same work. I say he's old news, and I also feel that we have a whole new slate of candidates that we could be looking forward to. Why is this constant need to go backwards? Why are we not looking to these younger candidates that have none of these issues and recognize the importance of not touching someone and kissing them and smelling their hair? That's ridiculous.
Alicia, thanks a lot for the call. Alicia's not alone. I think there are other Democrats, maybe of another generation, saying very similar things, Lauren.
Absolutely. I mean, you think about the breadth of this Democratic field. I mean, granted, Joe Biden's not in it yet, but I mean, one of the youngest members wasn't even born when he entered the Senate. I mean, this is the stretch of his career. And when you talk about him being old fashioned, some of these other candidates were just naturally raised in different eras. And so these sort of social mores that we're discussing right now are very second nature to them. This is how they were raised, and this is the environment they were raised in. So I think, you know, Joe Biden, especially given his long record, you know, if you take it, he's already been being kind of asked and talking about the Anita Hill Supreme Court confirmation hearing. He's apologized for that. So I think taken as a whole, you know, there's this question of is he, you know, generationally outdated for this new young party?
Let's give a listen now. The vice president's team and he on his Twitter site put up a video responding to this. Here's a quick listen.
Social norms have begun to change. They've shifted. And the boundaries of protecting personal space have been reset. And I get it. I get it. I hear what they're saying. I understand it. And I'll be much more mindful. That's my responsibility. My responsibility, and I'll meet it.
So, no way to predict this, I guess. Is that going to be enough for people?
Exactly. I mean, he didn't explicitly apologize to any of these women in the video, and I wonder if that encourages other women to come forward. You know, as we've said before, a lot of his behavior happened in public. He did this, you know, very openly. This is, again, part of who he is. So I do wonder if some of these other women will start to say, you know, that's me in this photo with him, and actually I felt uncomfortable then, and, you know, I wish he would have just apologized or taken ownership of that. Nonetheless, he is, you know, sort of saying, like, I get it, and I see that it's changed, and I, too, will change my behavior, especially if I do run for president in 2020. So, you know, he is at least accepting, he's sort of casting it as we were talking about earlier, as, you know, rules have changed, norms have changed, and I too will change with them.
Talking to Lauren Gambino from The Guardian about some of the top stories from the nation's capital this week. Coming up, President Trump was making a big case that Republicans should make a push soon on health care. Then he's backed away from that, said maybe after 2020. You can join in still at 800-642-1234. Should Republicans make a health care push? Is it an issue they should run on in the next couple of years? How about Democrats? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Lauren Gambino from The Guardian, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Now we'll turn to healthcare. I want to give a listen to President Trump speaking at the National Republican Congressional Committee dinner last night.
The Republican Party will be the champion of pre-existing conditions. You have to do it. Some of you like it, some of you don't. But you're going to have to like it, not only for politics, it's the right thing.
But President Trump, there was a kind of a back and forth between him and Republicans on a focus soon on health care. What's been going on, Lauren?
Well, so right after the Mueller report, the conclusions came out, Donald Trump decided to seize the moment. He was really exuberant out of the conclusion that his team hadn't colluded with the Russians, and he decided to announce this new health care initiative. Well, Republicans, you know, in very recent memory, remember their efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act being defeated multiple times. And they do not want to have that fight right before, you know, the big presidential election. They're just not ready to have that fight, especially with Nancy Pelosi controlling the House. What's the point was, you know, their thinking on this. So Donald Trump has, you know, over the last few days, he's been hearing from a lot of his Republican colleagues who are very confused on why he would turn to health care. The one issue where a lot of them believe they lost the majority in the House on this issue. Democrats really went out strong, you know, campaigned on health care. They made this about the health care election. They used it to draw contrast with their Republican opponents, and they won the House. So we've heard Mitch McConnell even spoke to the president and effectively told him, I'm not bringing this up in the Senate. So, you know, switch gears. So now we've seen Trump walk back from that. He is, you know, he had declared the Republican Party would be the party of health care. Now he's sort of walking back and saying he's going to have this great plan, but you've got to wait till after the 2020 election. That's when he's going to bring it forward, and that's when they're going to have this big vote. So now he's kind of dangling it for, you know, reelect me and we'll have this great new health care plan. Though, to be fair, that is sort of what he said in 2016, and it didn't work after that when he was the president. They had full control, when Republicans had full control of Congress. So whether that, you know, works as a message, we will see. But as of right now, it looks like healthcare has definitely been punted at least for now.
Bring out a caller on this. Eric is with us in Madison. Eric, hello.
Hi. Firstly, I guess if you believe anything that comes out of the White House, good luck to you, because there hasn't been a plan for anything from day one, whether it be health care reform or the border wall. It's all shoot from the hip. I mean, the guy doesn't recall where his father was born at. But number two, if there was a plan, you're not gonna do anything until you do something with campaign finance. They're all funding the politicians' political agenda, and it's just back and forth and switch politics.
Eric, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for calling in. Eric, referring to the president, referring to his father being born in Germany a few times lately. He was born in New York City. But Eric's point, is this something that Republicans in Congress are feeling, a sense that there isn't a plan, that the president is making this up as he goes?
Yes, and that was part of their reaction, that, you know, they were sort of blindsided by this. You know, healthcare is the one issue that really dogged them. They really tried hard in 2017, and they just could not pass a repeal. And, you know, eventually some of the plans were repeal and replace, but there were multiple efforts to do this, and they couldn't get it through. So, you know, Republicans in Congress do not have a consensus plan that they believe could even pass the Senate, which is controlled by Republicans, you know, not even getting into the House, which is controlled by Democrats. So yeah, I think they were a bit blindsided by this. You know, obviously the White House isn't the one generating a healthcare plan. Trump has actually been all over the map in terms of what he supports. You know, this idea of sort of telling them to embrace pre-existing conditions, which Republicans have come around to since the Affordable Care Act was passed and under Obama. But, you know, that is one of the most popular pieces of the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, initially Republicans were against everything to do with the Affordable Care Act, and they came around to pre-existing conditions. Several of them defended it when they were being challenged in 2018. So that, you know, that is something Republicans are coming around on. And a lot of the plans you could imagine would try to protect pre-existing conditions. But as a whole, you know, as a big, broad, sweeping plan, it's not there. And his point, you know, his point is correct. There isn't a White House plan. There isn't a Republican congressional plan. And so that was part of the confusion and just the reason that Republicans were so confounded.
Talking to Lauren Gambino. Thanks for that call. She's from The Guardian. We're looking at some of the top stories in national politics. We invited you earlier to call about some of these accusations and concerns about former Vice President Joe Biden. I want to bring on another caller or two on that. Karen is with us in Milwaukee. Karen, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, I feel kind of differently than a lot of people, I guess. I was honored this fall to meet Joe Biden at a rally in Milwaukee, and I had the opportunity to talk with him, and I shared with him that I appreciated some of his comments on some of the issues. He took me by the hand, and he kissed me on the cheek. I was not in any way uncomfortable. I thought it was a warm gesture. I felt like my comments were appreciated. I'm close to his age. I'm 68.
I'm going to jump in, Karen. Thank you for sharing that story. We're just about out of time. Lauren, we're going to be watching this. It's early in the primary process, not even the primary process. Biden isn't even in the campaign. 30 seconds. What are you watching for on this story?
I'm watching to see if more women come forward. I'm watching to see what his team does next. They've tried several times to respond to it, and today they did do this video. And you've kind of started to hear rumblings, you know, what if he doesn't run? And that's such a death sentence for people in his position debating whether to come. So I'm kind of seeing whether, you know, how he grapples with that and how strongly he defends himself and in the face of what might be more accusations.
Thanks, Lauren, for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Lauren Gambino, The Guardian's political correspondent. She joined us for our weekly look at the latest stories in national politics. Thanks for your calls. If you still want to weigh in on these concerns about Joe Biden and just where he fits into this growing ever-growing Democratic presidential field, you can email us, ideas@WPR.org, or we're always available on Twitter. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let us know what you think about that or the other top issues in national politics we've talked about today. Well, science fiction nerds like me are excited, maybe ambivalent. There's a new movie in the works based on the legendary sci-fi novel Dune. Chris Molina, producer extraordinaire, you and I have been talking about the Dune books for a lot of years now.
I'm kind of excited because this is one of the sci-fi series that I've actually read or tried to read. I love the first book. Mm-hmm. I discovered it several years ago. And then, like, slowly over time, I tried to read the other books in the series. I got as far as the last one in the original series, Chapter House Dune, and it was just incomprehensible. And, you know, I want to love these books so much, but I'm excited about the movie because the original book is really a classic.
I like the first book. I've reread it, and I did the same thing. I had a thing where I'd buy for 50 cents at used bookstores the sequels, and if I'd get sick or laid up or something, I'd read them. And it's kind of a masochistic exercise. Some people love them.
Yeah, I mean, I can see why this would translate pretty well to film. I mean, you've got huge CGI sandworms. I mean, who doesn't love that? You've got kind of a cool story. You've got the spice, which is that mystical thing that makes the universe go. So there's a lot of cool ideas, but it's going to be interesting to see if they can pull it off or not.
It's been done. David Lynch did a weird version. There was a TV miniseries that I watched. It was surprisingly kind of dull.
Also, but they haven't really mined this universe yet, which is surprising.
Spice Mind, for
kind of a sci-fi classic. So I guess I'm a little surprised it took this long.
All right. Fear is the mind killer, Chris. Thanks for joining us. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.